Our next case for argument is 21-1849, Idacre Farms versus United States. Mr. Toth, please proceed.
Madam Chief Judge, and may it please the Court, Brian Toth from the Department of Justice, representing the United States as a defendant appellant in this case. Claims Court held the United States liable to pay just compensation for taking property on plaintiff's property due to changes that the Army Corps of Engineers made to the operation and configuration of the Missouri River and main stem reservoir system and related navigation improvements. Those changes had the effect of reducing the flood control protections that the Corps had already been providing to plaintiffs on their properties for approximately four decades, but they did not unequivocally eliminate those benefits altogether, as would be required to establish a taking. Claims Court erred in a number of respects that we outline in our brief, but I'd like to focus my presentation on a couple of them here today, namely causation and relative benefits. The Claims Court committed the overarching error of failing to examine the baseline that was appropriate for determining whether a taking has occurred. It excluded the consideration of what would have occurred absent the system and its improvements altogether. Plaintiffs did not even attempt to put on a case of evidence to demonstrate.
I'm sorry, but that wasn't ignoring the baseline. It's just taking a different view of the baseline from the one you have.
Fair enough. It was a rejection of our argument that the proper baseline should be set to consider the benefits of the property.
And the CFC said the baseline is what existed at the time of the various investments, subject to a question about what the reasonable expectations of alteration were at that time, and then finding as a fact that there was no reasonable expectation of the kind of dramatic change in priority that occurred in 2004. Is that a fair summary, at least, of what the CFC held?
I think in general, I would quibble a little bit about the role of expectations in the analysis. Causation is a sine qua non for takings liability. We saw this in the St. Bernard Parish decision. Without causation alone, there cannot be a taking. Similarly, Alford makes clear that relative benefits is a complete defense to taking, apart from any injection of the expectations of the landowners. And while Arkansas Game and Fish mentions reasonable investment-backed expectations as a factor in determining whether there is liability for a taking by flooding, we believe that the mistake that my friend makes and that the claims court also made is that the reasonable expectation of the landowner cannot be injected into the causation analysis for the relative benefits analysis. It's analogous, for example, to
even if the reasonable expectation is a matter of is judged objectively and not in a party specific way.
That's correct, and I would point the court to this court's predecessor's decision in the Accardi case, where it rejected an argument in a taking by flooding context that the landowners were entitled to rely on an undiminished flow. It was a project that was relocating a railroad right-of-way during the that's a different case. It was a project that talked about the Trinity River Division of the Central Valley Project, and the landowners claimed that the flow could not be adjusted upward, even though they were not harmed compared to what occurred before the dam was in place. The court rejected the notion that they had an expectation.
This is the Shasta Dam case, is that?
I believe so, Northern California. Even if it's objectively considered, we don't think reasonable expectations play a role in the causation analysis. If they did, however, we don't believe that the expectations here of the landowners were reasonable such that the original operation of the system should be excluded from the analysis. And that's so for a number of reasons. Congress enacted a statute in 1944 in authorizing the construction and operation of the project specifically to include a number of purposes, not only flood control and navigation, but also fish and wildlife preservation.
This was clearly the priority and the long-standing priority, right?
This meaning flood control?
Yes.
It was a top priority, and we acknowledge that, and that's something that the Eighth Circuit has held in the multi-district litigation over this project. But since the inception of the project, through the statute, and then through repeated enactments and revisions of the manual, the Corps has made clear, well, Congress first made clear that fish and wildlife preservation were a purpose of the project. So it's not outside the realm of expectations altogether. And then secondly, the manual revisions always make clear that the operations will change based on changes in priority, based on legal policy. And certainly the Endangered Species Act's enactment is such a change.
Yes, but how can you argue that the property owners should have expected the government to stop prioritizing flood control and instead prioritize endangered species such that they should have expected to lose all their farmland when the government itself didn't think that were the case and in fact fought all the way through the court system whether they should have to make that change? So you're holding the property owners to a different standard of expectation even though all of the government people involved fought tooth and nail against that very principle. Why should the property owners have understood what the government itself did not?
I think you have to, if you're going to set aside, if you're going to look at the expectations objectively, I think it's fair to set aside the parties litigating positions and the vigorous defense by the United States of the course.
Why? Why set it aside because it doesn't benefit you in this case? Why are you setting it aside?
No, because if you look at it objectively, you would look not to the parties litigating positions in that single set of cases, but you would look to factors like what would Congress said in the original enactment, the various purposes. And yes, in 1944, we're not saying that landowners ought to have anticipated that Congress would enact the Endangered Species Act specifically, or that the Corps would be required to rebalance the priorities. But certainly, this is a much easier context than I think even St. Bernard Parish was, or even Hardwick was, because you're talking about adjustments to a single project, right? You're talking about changes to the operation and the configuration of the single project, and it's within the ambit of what Congress originally recognized.
So is there an example? I mean, is it the government's position that there are no guarantees in life, and therefore there can never be a reasonable expectation? Or can you give me an example of what the government would say would have been a reasonable expectation by the landowners here?
I'm not in a position to give you a hypothetical that results in liability on the facts of this case, because our position is because Congress provided the flood control benefits through its, it wasn't constitutionally compelled to undertake that program, and it has had to adjust the operations of various projects like this over
time. So there
can
never be a circumstance when it's legislated, when the changes come from Congress, there can never be a circumstance where anyone can rely on that in terms of making their investments, in terms of the resources, even if it lasts for decades. They have no reasonable basis for assuming that will continue as a priority.
So long as the flooding that occurs on the plant's property that they're complaining about is no worse than what would have occurred before the project was constructed or enacted, yes, that's our position.
And what's your case on that? Because St. Bernard wasn't precisely, the sequence of events was certainly different here in a way that clearly could have resulted in a different result. So what's your case here?
We think the reasoning in St. Bernard is logically extended to the situation as well. There isn't a precise case. To answer your question directly, there isn't a precise case on point, whether on point against us or in our favor, but we think the logic here is such that where Congress has undertaken this beneficial program, it cannot be ignored in the takings context. Otherwise, the landowners could be able to slice the government's action as thin as they wish to isolate the detrimental aspects of it and its operation from the benefits that they've received for years. And that's true whether you look at it through the lens of causation or whether you look at it through the lens of relative benefits.
But with a 25, 40-plus year difference, we're not really close to a tough case of slicing, are we?
It has the possibility. I'll give you an example. And the Hurricane Harvey litigation that came before this court, it's ongoing in the claims court. The claims there are made by both upstream and downstream plaintiffs of a Corps project that when the Corps operated a dam in response to flood events from Tropical Storm Harvey, it closed the gates to hold water behind a dam and then opened the gates to release it at a lower rate than would have occurred if they had not had the project operating at all. The plaintiffs in that case are claiming that the opening of the gates caused the taking of property downstream, and they're isolating that opening of the gates during the same storm, from the closing of the gates.
What parties claim is not doesn't establish a judicial precedent to to worry about.
No, I understand. So maybe I can come at it from a different...
You're willing to sort of bite the bullet on, you know, reflooding Back Bay and Battery in New York City?
No, I think those examples of approval of dredge and fill permits, which CORE also has a role in, are very different from this, which is the ongoing operation of the project over the course of decades. With the filling of Back Bay, the CORE grants a one-time permit, and then its responsibilities are done. Okay, it authorizes the placement of fill, and that becomes, you know, that's private property where a different development is built upon it, and the CORE has no further role. Here, Congress is continuing to fund through yearly appropriations or multi-year appropriations the operation of this project, and plaintiffs are continuing to receive benefits from it. So this is a different situation than the examples that my friend offers in the opposing briefs. But I want to get at this from a different angle as well. I think the effect of the claims court's ruling here is to give to plaintiffs, it's the flip side of Judge Prost, what your question was getting at, which is that Congress enacts the benefits, and the claims court's decision turns it into a one-way ratchet such that the benefits accrue to the landowner's property, their title to the property, and they become a compensable interest in their property. So it's as if, the flowage easement here is granted for the CORE to have the right to diminish the flood control benefits that it's been providing for these decades to these landowners. And that's it's a very odd way, one, of conceptualizing the flowage easement concept.
Is it a comfort at all to you that what St. Bernard said, inaction is not a taking, so you could, by inaction, end up having some deprivation of the comparative dryness of the land for which the government would not be responsible, but this is not an inaction case, and you haven't argued that it is.
Correct. We haven't argued that, but, you know, the logical implication of that is that it would incentivize the government to walk away from a project that it's got the statutory responsibilities to operate on an ongoing basis. There can't be inaction here. So, you know, we're in a catch-22 because Congress has directed the Corps to continue operating this project. And so the result is that the plaintiffs get, under the claims court's ruling, a right to compensation for any enhancement in the flood control benefits of the project without having to accept the detriments that might result when the Corps needs to rebalance the priorities within the scope of what Congress has contemplated. I'm into my rebuttal time, so unless the Court has any further questions,
I'll save the balance. Let's hear from Mr. Varelli.
May it please the Court, I'm Don Varelli for the plaintiffs, appellees, cross appellants. In view of the argument that my friend Mr. Toth made this morning, I think it would be helpful to start with a focus on six key findings of the trial court, unchallenged findings, that I do think refute what my friend said just now and establish a taking that requires just compensation. First, and this is at pages 10 and 11 of the appendix, the government constructed the Missouri River flood control system in the 1940s and 50s to disconnect the river from the floodplain for the purpose, among other things, of creating arable farmland that people can invest in. Second, the government induced the plaintiffs to farm this arable land based on assurances of flood control, and the plaintiffs relied on that inducement. That's pages 361 to 71, the appendix, those findings. Third, a half century later, the government dismantled much of the flood protection system to reconnect the river to the floodplain because a court had held that the Endangered Species Act required the government to create shallow water habitat for protected species. That's at pages 15, 23, 25, and 6 of the appendix. Fourth, and this is critical, I think, in view of my friend's argument this morning, the 2004 decision was a dramatic shift, not an adjustment as he described it. It required a massive new construction project that tripled the budget for the management of this project. There were more than 1,600 notches created in the dams, more than 300 water sheets that had been closed were open. There was massive construction for 10 years along this stretch of the river. Those findings are again at 25 and 26 of the appendix. Fifth, and I think this is also critical, the 2004 shift was not within anyone's contemplation, not the government's, and certainly not plaintiffs', when plaintiffs purchased and invested in this land. That finding is at page 282 of the appendix. And sixth, the shift caused severe recurrent flooding on plaintiff's land that would not have occurred had the government not made the shift. And that's at pages 351 to 353.
So all of these, I mean, it's a little harder for us because you've given us six facts. As the suggestion might be that we could ask, if you pull one of those out, does that change the result? What is the most compelling aspect of those findings? Is it the long-standing assurances that the government made and the reliance
on your clients? What I would suggest, Your Honor, is that the key is, now turning to the law, thinking about Hardwick and Miller, the key is what would the landowner have reasonably contemplated at the time that the landowner made the investment? If the landowner would reasonably contemplate, based on the circumstances that existed then, that the flood protection would continue, then I think the answer is that that's the key that they'd be taking. But if at the time that the landowner made the investment, the landowner would reasonably contemplate that the government was going to take an action in the future that would inflict the harm, then there would not be a taking in that circumstance. And that's exactly
what's the timing of the investment? I mean, so suppose you had a landowner in 1970 says, I think I've got a couple of decades of stability of the government policy here. It's a good investment. I'll farm for 20 years. Who knows what happens after that?
Right.
And then the government, you know, looks at the 1979 manual and says, this is not exactly rigid. It prioritizes flood control over other things, but we're going to shift the policy.
Right. So I'm going to answer Your Honor's question directly, but I want to make a general point, and then I'll get the specifics. The general point being, what the Supreme Court said in Arkansas Game and Fish, which is no bright-line exclusionary rules. Every case has got to be decided on its particular facts. The equities in that case might be somewhat different depending on the nature of the assurances, et cetera. But this is an easy case. This was a case in which these farmers bought this land based, as the court found, on assurances of flood protection. They cleared
it. Roughly when?
In, very soon after the programs put in place in the 1950s, et cetera. So not many decades in. And again, I would think, you know, even in 1970 here, I think those landowners, those purchasers, would have a reasonable expectation that they weren't going to be subject to this because...
I guess the point, the emphasis I was trying to place on it is the difference perhaps between a reasonable expectation of a fairly extended period of protection of the land for farming, but that when that expectation, if that's all there was, or if that's all that was reasonable, was not violated by doing something, you know, 25 or 40 years later.
Yeah, so I do think it's why that's one important factor, but that's why you've got to consider all the facts and circumstances, and I'll pick up on something that Your Honor raised earlier about the difference between action and inaction here. It might be one thing that a farmer wouldn't be able to have a reasonable expectation that flood protection would continue in perpetuity. Government might run out of money, et cetera. But here, that's not what happened. There was a specific affirmative, and as the trial court found, dramatic policy change to make a decision to invade the plaintiff's land by releasing the water to create the shallow water habitat on the plaintiff's land. And so whatever might have been, we can argue about expectations based solely on the existence of flood protection, but this was that specific change which resulted in a physical invasion deliberately done by the government is really a key thing here. And there is a finding, again, which I said at the outset, where the trial court found that that was not in anybody's expectation, and as Your Honor recognized, that's in part because the government fought this change tooth and nail.
What was the specific action that you think constituted the taking? Is it the dam releases? Was it the structures on the side of the river that were abolished? What are the specific actions that the government took?
I think it is the series of specific actions over a 10-year period starting in 2004, going for 10 years, which included the opening hundreds of water chutes that had previously been closed, let water flow through them onto plaintiff's land and otherwise, putting the 1,679, I think it is, notches in the dams that were created, again, to increase water flow, various other projects, the specific purpose of which was to increase the water flow, including onto our property. And so I think it is that project that they undertook under court order starting in 2004, but those were specific things. It's like opening chutes, letting the water rush out onto our land. That's the essence of it. And this, I do think, allows me, if I could, to just make a point on statute of limitations. A question about, okay, when does this claim accrue? I think this does, the fact that the construction itself went on for a 10-year period, that this was exactly the quintessential case for the application of the stabilization doctrine, which the Supreme Court said in Dickinson is a practical and not a technical doctrine. And it's important in a situation where you're going to have recurrent flooding of this kind to have enough time to wait and see when things stabilize.
Accepting that, do the events preceding that stabilization period of 2014 constitute temporary takings, if they are takings at all?
Yes, certainly a part of I guess the way I would phrase it, Your Honor, is that it's a permanent taking, and the taking is occurring during the stabilization period. We don't know until we reach stabilization just how severe it's going to be, and that's why the doctrine exists, because you don't want landowners to rush in early.
I was thinking about it like this, because I was trying to wrap my head around the same concept that Judge Brooks was just asking you about, which is, can you recoup damages for the activities before stabilization if the claim didn't accrue? And I was thinking of it like this. Am I right in understanding that the accrual and the statute begins to run from when you knew or should have known?
Exactly.
So clearly there may be instances in which a reasonable person should not have realized that something was taken from them, but it was nonetheless taken. So the accrual becomes when they knew or should have known, but the thing that might have been taken before that is something they can claim compensation.
That's exactly how we think about it, Your Honor. I think it's an excellent analogy is the discovery rule in a tort case, that your claim doesn't accrue until you discover the facts that lead you to understand that you've been injured by a certain cause. But then you get to recover for the whole period of injury. It's the same basic idea. And it's really, as the Supreme Court said in Dickinson, it's a pragmatic idea here that you don't want piecemeal litigation. You don't want plaintiffs rushing in too early. You don't want them to do actually what my friends, as I'd say, we should have done here, which is run into court in 2007 and the sign of the first major flood. You know, had we done so, they would have said, you can't claim a taking based on one flood. That's like classic government
argument. I think
one
can agree that
right.
Might have been.
So I just think that's exactly why we have the stabilization doctrine. And if I could just make one, this is a cross-appeal point about that. I'm sorry.
Can I just ask one follow-up on the same topic we've just been on? Once the thing is stabilized in 2013 or 2014, one is looking back, and is it right to say that one is recharacterizing the legal status that is now what happened in 2007 and 2008 has a legal character that it didn't actually have at the time, which is a kind of odd notion?
Yeah, I think about it differently, Your Honor. I take your point. I think about it differently. I think about it more in the way that Chief Judge Moore described, that it was a taking during that period. Its character was a taking during that period. But
a permanent taking or a temporary taking?
Because this is a permanent change, it would be a permanent taking. That was its character all along, but until you reach the point applying a stabilization doctrine of deciding that that things have stabilized sufficiently that a claim has accrued, you don't have to sue. And the doctrine is trying to discourage people from suing too early.
Is it that these under the Arkansas standards, assuming that they apply to a permanent taking, which I guess is actually not at all a settled question, has this unusual character of taking place over an extended period of time? Because ordinarily, there's all this law about you value things as of the date of the taking, as if it is a single date, which this seems to be a little out of keeping with.
Well, that's, I think, the whole reason you have the stabilization doctrine, particularly in flooding cases.
Except the stabilization doctrine is about the Tucker Act accrual of the cause of action, not about the specific timing of the wrong.
I do think the Arkansas Fish and Game analysis of remand to this court, I do think it's helpful in that if one looks at it, there were damages awarded for the harm to the timber during the period of the temporary taking, and there were damages awarded for the future losses caused by the damage during that period. And I think that maps on very closely here. Here, the just compensation was awarded for the diminution in value of the property going forward, but that didn't capture the crop losses during that interim period. And I've seen it in my rebuttal time, but I do want to make one point, if I could, at the expense of my rebuttal time, back on the merits with respect to Hardwick and Miller. My friend says that we're arguing for a one-way ratchet. Not at all. Expectations will differ in a case like this one from a case like Hardwick. I think they're the ones who are really making that heads I win, tails you lose argument. They say if it's a case like Hardwick where you could reasonably contemplate the change, you can't bring a taking claim. But even if you can't have reasonably contemplated the change, you can't bring a taking claim. And Your Honor asked the question about their standard. I would suggest, Your Honor, look at page 31 of their brief, where they say in all cases that you should be deemed to have contemplated the future change. It's really a legal argument. It has nothing to do with the facts. And that can't possibly be right. They can try to distinguish Battery Park City if they want, but it doesn't work. I mean, it's the same thing. If you go back to pre-filling Battery Park City, it wasn't with anything. And then their theory, really, I think, if the government decided to undo the Tennessee Valley project and knock down all those dams for environmental reasons, and Chattanooga was underwater half the time, on their theory, no problem. No taking.
Mr. Verrilli, you don't get to sit down. I'm going to extend your time because I have questions about your cross-appeal, and I'll extend the government's time equally.
Of course.
So I'd like to know what your argument is about the 2011 year. There was one year in which the Court of Federal Claims excluded that period because of the really sort of catastrophic, excessive flooding. She made fact findings that in that particular year, there was just so much rainfall that the flooding would have occurred regardless of the actions of the Army Corps of Engineers. So what is your argument about why that is nonetheless a taking?
So two points to make. First, Your Honor, I think it was premised on an error of law, and it's not just a factual question. As we read the trial court's ruling, the trial courts have essentially found, well, the mechanism and the timing by which the water was released in 2011 differed from the mechanism and the timing in other years, and therefore I'm not going to consider it to be taking. But the mechanism and the timing of the release of the water was all done pursuant to the same project that they had undertaken starting in 2004.
I guess let me ask you my question since we do have limited time more directly. So I was kind of thinking a lot about water and how the more water you have, the further it goes. I have four children. They spill stuff all the time. One glass of water on the kitchen floor may go oh so far, but an entire pitcher full of water is going to spread further and thereby cause more water damage. So my question to you is, did you argue this from the factual position of apportionment? Ah, yes. In this particular year, 2011, there were catastrophic, rainfall efforts, which may have resulted in flooding on some of our properties. Nonetheless, the government contributed to the extensiveness of that flooding. The flooding was more than it would have otherwise been because of the government's actions. And as such, there should be some degree of damages. Perhaps it's not 100% because maybe portions of your land would have flooded simply by virtue of the excessive rainfall, but that you should nonetheless be entitled to some analysis for apportionment purposes, looking at, well, what portion of the flooding did the government actually cause by its actions, as opposed to God?
Yes.
Did you make that argument?
Yes.
And did she address that argument? I didn't see her to have addressed that argument.
I don't have the record site handy. I would see when I sit down if I can find it. But I do think this does go to a factual error that we did point out, which is I think that the judge made an error by misunderstanding and dismissing our expert's causation analysis, which did address, among other things, the issue that Your Honor just...
I mean, did it specifically address the fact that there may have been flooding vis-a-vis an act of God that wasn't the result and cause of the Army versus Corps of Engineer actions, but their Army Corps of Engineer actions worsened the damage to our property, and therefore that worsening is the portion that we ought to be able to claim?
I believe so, Your Honor, but I don't want to get out of my skis too far. Let me confirm it.
Okay, now I want to move you to your crop claims. No, you still don't get to leave. You still don't get to leave.
I'm happy to stay here as long as you like, Your Honor.
Yes, well, especially when I'm talking about your cross appeal, that probably makes you very happy. So on the crops issue, am I right in understanding that the potential damages for the crops could be three times the diminution in the value of land, or in some instances, quite a big chunk of change?
It could be quite a bit, right? Because you're talking about an extensive period of...
So I was trying to think of crops like this. I was trying to, in my head, think about, if this were trees, or if this were a structure on the land, like, say, the levee in this case. You know, you planted something, it was property, and it was destroyed by the flood. Why would you not be entitled to that?
Right, and I do think it pretty follows, and I tried to suggest this to Judge Trumpler earlier, I think it follows pretty directly from Arkansas Game and Fish.
I understand these are friendly questions. So the next question I have, though, is what would the value of what you lost be? Would it be the value it was worth on the day it was destroyed, or the ultimate value had it matured? And here's why I ask. Suppose I was in the process of building a house, and I had only poured the foundation and maybe gone a little further, and then the government came and took the land. I can't charge them the $1 million the final house may have ultimately been worth someday, because it wasn't a final house. It was only a portion of a house. So how do you assess damages on immature crops, crops that had... So if your crops were at their full height and ready to be harvested, then you would have the full value of the market value of those crops. But if the crops are at their infancy, maybe they were just seeds recently planted, what is the measure of damages in a situation like that?
So I think it's the value of the mature crops. And again, I would analogize to Arkansas Game
and
Fish.
It has to be the value of mature crops minus whatever you saved
Yes, of course, Your Honor. That's exactly right. But the baseline would be, and I think Arkansas Fish and Game points in that direction with respect to the future damage, because there the future damage to the timber was damage to immature trees that didn't grow to full maturity because of the sogginess of the soil.
What about the never planted crops?
So
there's the mature crops, the seedlings or little ones, but then they flooded it and we never got anything in the ground.
Yeah, I think probably there would be a claim there too.
What?
Because
now you're going too far.
Well, fair enough. I'm content to have the court draw the line where it thinks the line should be drawn.
All right, Mr. Varelli, I'm going to fully restore your rebuttal time. We went over by quite a bit. Do you know how much we went over by? Did you keep track?
5.5.
Okay, so we're going to add that time. I'm going to restore your rebuttal time, and I'm going to add that time into the government's rebuttal time now.
Thank you.
Yes.
Judge Moore, to follow up, on your question from my opening presentation, about you made an assumption that plaintiffs lost all their land. That's not the case, and you may know that from our briefs, that they still retained economic value of portions of their crops. Their business still remains profitable, so it's not a complete taking that the court found. It's a diminution.
Yeah, but this is a physical taking, so we don't have to look like at that anemic Penn Central analysis and the whole property.
But the Arkansas Game and Fish factors in some instances mimic some of those factors, and one of which is the severity of the interference, and that diminishment is not enough under the Penn Central case law to constitute taking.
Yes, but this is a physical taking.
No, I understand.
The Supreme Court has made clear, so.
No, I understand. The proportions, though, are out of step with what the court normally finds would give rise to a regulatory taking, which is at least 50%. Here, the diminutions.
Yes, but this isn't a regulatory taking. Why are you still talking about it?
Because the factors are, the Arkansas Game and Fish factors are based, drawn from some of that same case law.
But is it, can I just ask, is there any reason in this case, either looking to what we have to decide right now in front of us or what is pending still in the unresolved plaintiff's claims, for us to decide whether the Arkansas analysis applies to a permanent flooding taking as opposed to the temporary one that existed there?
So we haven't, I mean, the parties have assumed that it does apply, but we haven't briefed that specific question. I would urge the court, if it's going to consider that, take briefing on that specific point. But, I mean, this entire case has been litigated on the assumption.
When you ask us, you would like us, if we're going to consider it, Arkansas Game and Fish is throughout these briefs.
So,
and you all treated it as
right.
though it were applicable. So why would we need additional briefing? You had a lot of opportunity for briefing on exactly this point and did.
Well, I think the parties assume that it applies. And so that's how the court ought to.
Is that true of the other plaintiffs, the ones who are not here?
I'm not sure that
okay.
that's the case.
That's
so to get to my friend's recitation of the six factual findings that he says are dispositive here, I would just emphasize that this notion about the scope of the project and whether the changes to the operation and configuration of the system are within the scope of what was originally contemplated is a legal question. It's an issue of essentially foreseeability. And so factual findings ought not to matter. It's a legal question the court reviews de novo. Regarding the application of what my friend calls the Miller and Hardwick rule, St. Bernard Parish expressly left open the possibility that Hardwick's discussion did not apply to causation, and that it was simply, because it applied Miller, it was simply related to valuation questions, which are not what's determinative here. We would submit that it's a different analysis when it comes to relative benefits and when it comes to causation. And I would point out in Alford, which was the most recent relative benefits case, the court emphasized that it's a relative benefits is a very broad concept, and it didn't indicate in any way that
it was limited. Does it matter that the purpose of the original project was to control floods, the purpose of the 2004, et cetera, actions was to some extent the opposite, but certainly it was not to control floods. It was willing to sacrifice the increased floods for other goals.
I don't think it matters because if you look at St. Bernard Parish, which is presumably a harder case because there were two different projects, but yet the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet's purpose was for navigation, whereas the purpose of the Lake Pontchartrain and vicinity levees were for flood control protection, yet the court found those two different projects were sufficiently related so as to be, and further found, to have that nexus, and further found them foreseeable.
Could I ask you to turn to the cross appeal, please?
Yes. And so, first on the 2011 flooding, your question, Chief Judge Moore, was about apportionment. Frankly, they did not put on that case about what increment of flooding was attributable to the United States' actions as opposed to what was attributable to the.
So I hear you
rainfall.
Saying that. The problem for me, and you may well be right, the problem for me is if we were to get to that point, the record here is just so tremendous. It's hard for me to go into that level of detail. And quite frankly, both parties didn't spend sufficient time briefing this so that I can appreciate what really was argued and not argued. If they did make that argument, if I were going to reach that point, and I was concerned that there ought to be apportionment under circumstances like you heard me describe, wouldn't the proper course of action for me to be vacate remand to say nothing? And to let the trial court figure out whether or not they made a sufficient case. Because here's the problem. This is just, three property owners or however many it is, and there's hundreds more waiting in the wings for this. So if that apportionment argument wasn't made here, it may well be made in one of these yet-to-develop records.
No, I understand. And I don't dispute that that would be a reasonable approach if you disagree with the government on the main liability points. Turning to the crops, I think that the agricultural crops here at issue are different from trees in Arkansas Game and Fish. I don't mean to be flip about this, but the rationale for including the destruction of timber in Arkansas Game and Fish was that the destruction of timber was a proxy for measuring the temporary taking that occurred there. Here the court found a permanent taking. And so the crops are, you can know at the end of the crop season whether they are harvestable or not. That's not the case with timber, which requires examination over a longer period of time to determine whether it's going to be merchantable.
I don't understand why that makes them not compensable. I mean, why aren't they like a house or a structure or a levee or anything else? I don't understand. Why are they not compensable? They were taken. They were destroyed. Why are they not compensable?
Because under the Court of Claims precedent in Barnes, even in a permanent taking context, damages that occur to crops while a taking is ripening, say, while it's temporary, are not compensable.
Okay, but perhaps that covers maybe up until the date of accrual, theoretically, but what about the crops planted after accrual? Even if that Barnes proposition is correct, which I have some serious doubts about,
sure.
What about the crops? Because the crops weren't limited to the pre-accrual date. There were plantings of crops that were destroyed after the accrual.
Right.
What would your possible argument be for why those are not compensable?
Well, I think it highlights the anomaly of the selection of the later date of taking. I mean, it's very strange, to say the least, to have a takings claim that did not accrue until.
I know. Now you're not answering my question at all, though, and you're coming up on the end of your time.
No, I understand. I don't
have an answer.
Difference. Correct. But I think what it highlights is the anomaly of the trial court's finding about when the claim accrued, which was 2014, 7 years after the first flooding occurred. And we think the record by the plaintiff's own theory of the case in their complaint, they complained about a change in flooding.
You heard my discussion with opposing counsel about the statute of limitations period and this concept of being able to get damages that go backwards prior to the date of accrual because the standard is new or reasonably should have known kind of thing. So if it hasn't stabilized and hasn't been perfected yet, the accrual date could be later, but then you realize it. Why aren't you allowed to go backwards and get the damage that was caused?
I would just come back to Barnes and.
Well, and then the other side answer to Barnes is that was called into question by Arkansas Gaming, right?
Right, which is my point about distinguishing Arkansas Gaming Fish. I mean, first of all, it wasn't expressly called into question, and furthermore, it's factually distinguishable because of the nature of the timber issue there being very different from seasonal crops.
Okay. So, thank you very much, Mr. Varelli, for restoring your 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. 3 points. First, the diminution issue, I mean, that does apply to the 2007-2014 period as well as afterwards. My friend on the other side made an argument, I think, that Your Honor correctly recognized was one applies to regulatory takings and not physical invasions. I just point out the Supreme Court's recent decision in Cedar Point. The union organizers were on the property for a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour in the evening, I think. And
you gave me. It gets two. Sorry.
I'm sorry. The union organizers were on the property for half an hour in the morning and half an hour at lunch or in the evening, and that was a permanent physical invasion that constituted a taking. And so if that, and Loretto, of course, was just running that one cable wire into an apartment, and that was a permanent physical invasion that constitutes a taking. And so the idea that the physical taking has to result in a diminution of more than 50% of the value of the property is just not right. It's just not right. Second, with respect to Barnes, we do think that it wasn't an accident that this court on remand in Arkansas Fish and Game didn't cite Barnes. I think it was because that was the very reasoning that the Supreme Court repudiated, that you shouldn't think of this as a taking. You should think about it as isolated tortious actions. And then third, with respect to the specific question of 2011, we're trying to find what the record says about it.
Do you have any objection to, if I were to be in your camp on the primary appeal, to me just vacating and remanding on that 2011 year to assess whether you did present a case for apportionment? Does that seem like a reasonable course of action?
Yes, I think that would be fine, Your Honor, because we've suggested even with respect to crop loss, there needs to be a remand to calculate what the damages are. And so with respect to 2011, that would be fine. Your Honor raised exactly the last point I was going to make, which is these are bellwether cases, and this is an issue that I think it would behoove everyone to get clarity on as to whether the claim could go forward under an appropriate standard.
Thank you. I thank both counsel. This case is taken under submission, and it was an excellent argument. We're both very helpful to the court, so thank you.